thanks for the introduction, Ron. And if you're looking in your program book, you're probably wondering why I'm standing up here instead of Bob Dineen. You heard his name referenced a few times this morning. Bob, unfortunately, is at home in bed, sicker than a dog. He's got a terrible stomach flu and thought it would be best not to come here and get all of you sick, which I agreed with. So I offered to stand in for Bob. I was told, reminded just before I came up here, that leaves some pretty big shoes to fill, but I'll do my best. Bob sends his apologies and his regrets. He really wishes he could have been here and wanted me to pass along his thanks and how pleased we are to be a co-sponsor of this event again with the U.S. Grains Council. So what I wanted to do, get the slides up here. Over the next 20 minutes or so is just talk a little bit about our perspective on the near-term outlook for ethanol policy and kind of the market outlook here in the U.S. And offer some thoughts on what that might mean for distillers' grains markets as well as other co-products. I wanted to start with just a few highlights on the success of the ethanol industry and how far we've come over the last 20, 25 years. Ethanol today is a ubiquitous component of the U.S. gasoline supply. It is blended in nearly every gallon of gasoline from coast to coast and border to border. Today, ethanol makes up about 10% of the U.S. gasoline supply. As we sit here today, ethanol is trading for about 60 cents less per gallon than gasoline at the wholesale level. That discount has been as much as a dollar a gallon or more in the last 8 to 12 months. And because ethanol has extended oil supplies, we've also put downward pressure on oil, and kind of the trickle-down effect of that is lower retail gasoline prices. There have been a few studies conducted recently that have found gasoline prices could have been anywhere from 80 cents to a dollar a gallon higher without the 14 billion gallons of ethanol that we blended last year. And again, that gets back to the effect that Mr. Casale was talking about this morning, where, you know, fuel is priced on the margin. It's the last barrel that sets the price, not the first. Ethanol has also supported nearly 400,000 American jobs. It's been a tremendous engine of rural economic development in the United States. It's generated about $50 billion in gross domestic product last year. And finally, ethanol has reduced harmful emissions, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, air toxics, particulate matter. So ethanol has obvious benefits in terms of air quality. Here's a look at the dramatic growth in U.S. ethanol production in recent years. The blue bars represent thousands or millions of gallons of ethanol produced annually going back to 1980. And as you can see, in about 2000, we were producing about 1.5 billion gallons per year. By 2005, that had grown to almost 4 billion gallons per year. And then we saw just incredible growth post-2005, which is the first year the renewable fuel standard was passed. And last year, we produced a record 14 billion gallons of fuel ethanol. The orange squares that you see on this chart reflect the renewable fuel requirements from the renewable fuel standard, or what some refer to as the mandate. And as you can see, since its enactment, we have always produced more ethanol than has been required by the policy, and that's a reflection of ethanol's economic value to refiners and blenders. The last couple years in particular, we have blended quite a bit more ethanol than the policy was actually requiring. The light blue bar is the projection for 2012. As you can see, we're looking at a reduction in ethanol output this year as a result of the drought conditions. I'm going to talk more about that in a moment. But 2012 would really be the first time since 1996 that we've actually seen a year-to-year reduction in ethanol output. One other note on the renewable fuel standard targets, again, that's the orange squares. You see, once we get to 2015, the requirement for renewable fuel levels off at 15 billion gallons, and it stays there until 2022, which is the last year of the renewable fuel standard. But really, the reason the ethanol industry is here today at this conference and the reason that we're a co-sponsor is because we produce more than fuel. As you folks all know very well, the ethanol industry is also a major producer of animal feed. And what this chart is showing is the volumes of the three major animal feed co-products that come from the U.S. ethanol industry. The blue portion of the bar is distillers' grains, and that would be all forms of distillers' grains, whether it's dried or wet or modified. The red portion of the bar is corn gluten feed, which comes from the wet mills. And then the green portion of the bar at the very top, the very small part, is corn gluten meal, which is also a wet mill product. But as you can see, we are contributing a substantial volume of animal feed to the global feed market. Last marketing year, we estimate that the production of these products was about 39 million metric tons, which is a tremendous amount of feed. Again, we expect output to be reduced somewhat in the current marketing year, 2012-2013, again, because the ethanol industry is using less corn in response to higher prices and tighter stocks. Along with the substantial growth that we've seen in distillers' grains production, we've also seen tremendous growth in exports of distillers' grains. And again, that's what we're here to talk about. This chart shows exports of distillers' grains going back to 1995. And you can see that between 1995 and really the middle of the last decade, distillers' grains imports tended to trend below 1 million metric tons per year. Then really in 2006, 2007, we began to see substantial growth in the export market, thanks in part to many of the educational programs and efforts of the U.S. Grains Council, but also due to efforts of private industry as well. We had a record export year for distillers' grains in 2010. About 9 million metric tons were exported. That number fell in 2011, as you can see there. And right now we're expecting 2012 exports to be very close to last year's levels of about 7.5 to 8 million metric tons. And I think it's easy to lose sight of just how significant distillers' grains have become in terms of their contribution to the global feed complex. Again, we were producing just, 5 or 6 million tons of this product several years ago. Last year, we were at nearly 39 million metric tons. And just to put that in a little bit of context, that means that the U.S. Ethanol industry is now producing more feed than the U.S. soybean crushing industry. We're producing more distillers' grains and corn gluten than we are soybean meal. If the U.S. industry, ethanol industry co-product supply was a corn crop, it would rank as the world's fourth largest corn crop, behind only the U.S., China, and Brazil. If all of these distillers' grains, if all of this feed was converted to hamburger or chicken, you can see how many hamburger patties or chicken breasts that would produce. And then finally, USDA and several nutritionists have looked at what is actually being displaced by distillers' grains when you put it in the animal feed ration. And what they found is that when you put a ton of distillers' grains into the ration, you're actually displacing more than a ton of other feed ingredients. And so that's that bottom bullet point kind of speaks to that, we're displacing, a pound of distillers or a kilogram of distillers' grains replaces about 0.9 kilograms of corn and about a quarter of a kilogram of soybean meal when you kind of aggregate it across all species. So here are some of the current issues or current factors that we're looking at and keeping an eye on that we think are going to influence the ethanol industry over the next 12 to 18 months. Some of these are policy issues, and some are just marketplace issues. And obviously, we talked a lot this morning about the impacts of the drought on corn supply and price. I want to talk about how our industry is responding to that. And then I also want to talk about the renewable fuel standard. There have been a few requests from certain state governors to waive the requirements of the RFS next year, and I want to talk about our view of what that might mean for the ethanol and co-product markets. First of all, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this since the drought was covered extensively this morning. USDA says this is likely the worst drought in at least 25 years. Many believe it's probably the worst in over 50 years, but certainly the worst since 1988. And you can see just how quickly the condition of the corn crop deteriorated. In the middle of June, about 9% of the corn crop was rated as poor or very poor, and by early August, half of the crop, fully half of the crop, was rated as poor or very poor. And that caused USDA to revise its projections of the size of this year's corn crop and projections of yield, and you can see those in the table down below. And obviously, because of this supply shock, we saw corn prices rise substantially and quickly in July, August. I want to talk for just a moment about how the ethanol industry has responded to the drought and higher corn prices and tighter stocks. There seems to be this false notion out there that because of the renewable fuel standard, because of the ethanol requirement, that ethanol producers are somehow insulated from high corn prices and this supply shock. And this chart shows that just isn't the case. The red line represents the weekly consumption of corn by the ethanol industry on an annualized basis. So that would be the axis on the right. And what you see is in June, the industry was consuming corn at a rate of about 5.1 billion bushels annualized. Then as prices ran up, which is the blue line, you saw the industry react very quickly and reduce its corn consumption, reduce its ethanol production rates down to a level that's somewhere in the 4.3 to 4.4 billion bushel level on an annualized basis. So again, in the course of a month and a half or 2 months, the ethanol industry reduced its demand for corn by about 600 to 700 million bushels. The drought conditions prompted several governors, and initially it was the governors of Arkansas and North Carolina, to request a waiver of the RFS, the ethanol blending requirements, in 2012-2013 marketing year. And their argument has been that, a waiver is going to reduce corn use for ethanol, and it's going to free up corn stocks for livestock feed use, and it's going to reduce corn prices. And we certainly don't agree with that, and I'll walk through some of the reasons why in a moment. But procedurally, the Environmental Protection Agency is now considering these waiver requests. They're also considering comments from stakeholders from all industries, livestock feeders, ethanol producers, the whole range of affected industries. And after they've done a good analysis of these comments and have done their own economic analysis, they will issue a decision on what to do with the renewable fuel standard for next year. And that decision is expected in mid to late November, certainly after the election. We believe that a waiver of the RFS is completely unnecessary, and we do not believe that it would noticeably impact corn prices or availability in the current marketing year. And here are some of the reasons why. As I showed on one of the previous charts, the markets are already adjusting. The ethanol industry has already reduced its corn consumption by about 15%. There's really no evidence that a waiver would provide any additional relief beyond that. There are flexibilities built into the Renewable Fuel Standard program, which basically allows credit trading. So if I am a oil company who is required to blend a certain amount of ethanol, if I blended more than my requirement in previous years, I can use the credits from over-complying in this year or in next year if I blend less ethanol than what my physical requirement is. Because of that flexibility, we're seeing the markets really respond rationally to higher corn prices and tighter stocks. And you can see how many of those excess credits, those blender RIN credits, are available on the market today. About 2.6 billion could be used in lieu of physical gallons of ethanol, and that's the equivalent of nearly a billion bushels of corn. The other reason that we don't think a waiver would really have much impact in the near term is that there is strong demand for ethanol irrespective of the RFS requirements. You heard Mr. Caselli this morning talk about ethanol's demand as an oxygenate, and he said, you know, as much as half of current ethanol use is driven by that demand. What he didn't say is beyond that, there is tremendous demand for ethanol as an octane source. And over the last several years, refineries have really retooled to use ethanol in lieu of other octane sources to meet their octane requirements. And right now, ethanol, as I said, is selling for about 60 cents a gallon less than gasoline and $1 to $2 per gallon less than other octane sources. So the point here is refiners are not just going to walk away from using ethanol if EPA decides to waive the program for next year. Several economists have looked at what the effect of a waiver might be on corn prices, and because there's strong demand for ethanol, irrespective of the RFS, they found that waiving the RFS would really not change corn prices in the 2012-2013 marketing year. The very latest study on this comes from the FAPRI group at the University of Missouri, and the blue bars represent corn prices without a waiver of the RFS, and the green bars represent what these studies suggest might be corn prices with a waiver of the RFS. And what you see here, obviously, is just a very small reduction. You know, again, the latest study says 4 cents per bushel might be the expected impact of a waiver of the RFS in the 2012-13 marketing year. And that's a less than a 1% reduction. More specific to this audience and your interests is what might happen to distillers grains markets with a waiver of the RFS and soybean meal markets. And there actually have been some economists that have looked at this. And one study found that if ethanol production was reduced by 500 million gallons, which is about 3%, and if biodiesel was reduced by about half, then you would see less soybean crushing, and so you'd see less soybean meal being produced. And you already have soybean meal prices at $500 a ton. Those would only go higher if a waiver reduced biodiesel output. The same is true for distillers grains. If a waiver was granted, you might see distillers grains prices increase by about 6%, commensurate with that 500 million gallon reduction. So while you might see slightly lower corn prices, and that 5.6% reduction in corn prices is a pretty, based on the last slide, a pretty generous estimate, some of that is going to be offset by higher prices for distillers grains, soybean meal, and other co-product feeds coming out of the ethanol and biodiesel industries. I want to talk very briefly about the E10 blend wall, which is another political issue, a policy and regulatory issue that we are facing today. Again, I mentioned earlier that the U.S. ethanol consumption is equivalent to about 10% of current gasoline demand. And until very recently, that was the maximum level of ethanol that could be blended with gasoline in the United States. EPA recently increased that level to 15%. Ethanol blends as a minimum for conventional automobiles, but the uptake for E15 has been very slow. The first gallons of E15 were sold commercially very recently. I think we're selling E15 at 12 stations now out of 140,000 stations nationwide. So this has been a very slow rollout process. There are other marketplace hurdles, other regulatory hurdles that really need to be negotiated before we're going to see widespread use of E15 in the United States. And certainly the effect of the drought on the corn market and feedstock availability has been a factor in the E15 commercialization process as well. Here in the U.S., all we've heard about all summer long is this drought and the effect of this drought on the U.S. corn crop and what it means to end users of corn here in the United States. But what all of us in this room understand very well is that grain and feed markets are global in nature, and that while we're looking at smaller crops here in the U.S., many other parts of the world are expecting record or near-record crops when we're talking about coarse grains, wheat, and rice. You heard some of this morning from Mr. Glauber and others. But the point here is, you know, we've heard a lot in the media about the short corn crop here in the U.S., but on a global scale, we're still looking at the second largest grain crop in world history. Just 2.5%, 2.6% smaller than last year's record crop. So here very quickly is kind of our outlook for 2013. None of this will come as a surprise to you after hearing what I've already presented. And the first two are fairly obvious. Corn stocks are going to be tighter than normal. And we're going to have one of the tightest stocks to use ratios that we've seen in this country for a very long time. Therefore, the expectation is we're going to continue to see higher than usual corn prices throughout this current corn marketing year. But what I really want to impress upon everyone is that all grain users are going to share in this demand rationing process. Again, corn use for ethanol is very likely to fall to its lowest level in 3 years, and could fall marginally lower than that if there is a waiver of the RFS. But on the flip side of that, distillers' grains production would also be reduced. We do expect, as Mr. Glauber was discussing this morning, that farmers will continue to be rational actors, and they will increase their corn acres next year or certainly hold steady on this year's corn acres. But again, a waiver of the RFS may be a signal to corn farmers that there may be less demand for corn than they're thinking right now, and that may cause them to plant some other crop. And certainly a return to a trend corn yield would likely result in a record U.S. crop next year. This is really, one of my last slides, and I just want to use it to make underscore a couple points that I've already made. And it's maybe a little bit hard to interpret in a short time, so I would encourage you to take a look at this when you get the follow-on materials after the meeting. But what this chart does is it compares corn demand for the major uses of corn from the 2011-12 marketing year to the current marketing year, 2012-2013. And again, the first point is that everybody is sharing in the pain. All users are rationing. You can see the bars on the far left represent feed use. They're expected to reduce their corn use by about 6%. The green bars are ethanol consumption, and distillers' grains are the yellow boxes on top. And when you move those yellow boxes over where they need to go, which is to export and to livestock feed, the second point is that livestock feed continues to be the number one use of corn produced here in the U.S., despite what we hear in the headlines about, ethanol consuming 40% of the corn crop. People forget to take that net impact of distillers' grains and move that product where it's actually being used in these balance sheets. So this is my final slide, and just to leave you with a few additional points to consider. I think we've shown, and again, Mr. Glauber confirmed this morning, ethanol growth has really moderated, and we expect only incremental increases in corn ethanol production in the next several years. The drought is affecting all users of corn. We expect feed co-product output, distillers' grains and corn gluten, to be down about 10% this year compared to the last marketing year. And the RFS, if a waiver of the RFS is granted, that could only exacerbate these co-product supply issues and could further increase prices. So that's what I had for you today, and I appreciate your time and attention. And I think we'll take a few questions.
How will the reduction in gasoline demand here in the United States affect the RFS in the next 3 to 5 years?
That's a very good question. I mentioned that the practical maximum of ethanol that we can blend with gasoline today is about 10%, because there's issues that still need to be resolved for E15. And so if gasoline demand is declining, you know, then the 10% of that market is also declining at the same time that you have RFS requirements increasing. So really, you know, the way around that blend wall is going to be 15% ethanol blends. We're also going to see refiners possibly turn in some of those excess RIN credits to comply with the RFS until E15 is more broadly available. But certainly, you know, falling gasoline demand at a time when requirements are increasing has been a difficulty, and certainly not something, you know, anyone would have expected 7 or 8 years ago when the RFS was first being talked about.
Neil Campbell, I consult for the U.S. Grains Council in Canada. Can you comment on the advanced biofuel mandate or some of that stuff, and just let us know where that's at and, sure, and some of the dynamics that are emerging around that?
Sure. Be glad to. And what Neil's referring to, I talked exclusively about the ethanol requirements that can be satisfied with corn ethanol today. But there's an additional portion of the renewable fuel standard that requires the use of what EPA calls advanced biofuels. And that would consist of ethanol from cellulosic materials. Sugarcane ethanol from Brazil falls into that category as well. And what we've seen so far is the production of those fuels, those advanced and cellulosic fuels, has not kept up with the original volumes laid out by Congress. And so EPA every year has the authority to reduce those requirements to a level that they think is more suitable based on what is actually available in the marketplace. And EPA has exercised that authority the last 3 years. They have dramatically reduced the cellulosic biofuel requirement, which is within the advanced biofuel requirement, because those fuels just haven't been available on the marketplace today. The requirement for other advanced biofuels has largely been satisfied with imported sugarcane from sugarcane ethanol from Brazil, as well as biodiesel produced from a whole range of feedstocks. As those requirements kind of increase moving forward, it's going to be more and more difficult to satisfy those requirements unless we see some dramatic growth in cellulosic ethanol production or other types of advanced biofuels in the near term. But again, there's lots of flexibility within the program where EPA can adjust those requirements on an annual basis based on their assessment of what's truly available in the marketplace. And that's why we don't think there's any need for Congress to get involved in looking at rewriting the program in any way.
Harry Gross with Global Industries. Jeff, could you address a little bit the flex fuel vehicles and the E85? I was shocked at the few number of stations on the E15. What's going on with the flex and the 85?
Sure, and Larry brings up a good point. I talked about ethanol's primary use, which is as a 10% ethanol blend. About 99% of the ethanol we produce today is consumed at that low-level 10% blend. But the other 1% or so is consumed as what we call E85, which is 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. That fuel can only be consumed in what is called a flexible fuel vehicle, or an FFV. Today, there's 12, 13 million of those vehicles on the road, which is, you know, 5% of our U.S. automotive fleet, but there are very limited retail outlets for E85. It's hard to find gas stations that sell E85. I think last count was there may be 2,500 or 3,000 stations that offer E85, and again, that's out of a universe of about 140,000 gas stations. So E85 hasn't caught on as nearly as quickly as we would like to see, and we think you know, E15 is primarily how we're going to grow the ethanol marketplace in the near term.
Could you comment about the second generation ethanol industry? How is it developing? when it's expected to reach industrial level.
Right.
When we would come.
Yeah, and this kind of falls on Neil's question from earlier. In terms of advanced biofuels, you know, second generation, we do have four commercial scale cellulosic ethanol facilities under construction today. Several of those, at least two of those, are very far along in terms of construction. So we expect by the end of next year, by the end of 2013, there will be commercial gallons of cellulosic ethanol being produced in the United States. Now, you know, the output of three or four plants is much less than the statutory volumes require. And again, that's why EPA will very likely reduce those requirements until there is sufficient commercial scale capacity to produce those other fuels. But, you know, one other thing I would say in response to that question is, you know, the cellulosic ethanol producers, the second generation developers, are keenly interested in what EPA does with the RFS waiver requests, and they will certainly interpret that decision as a signal, you know, with respect to the administration's support for this RFS program over the long haul. So cellulosic and advanced biofuel producers are adamantly opposed to any waiver of the RFS. Just as the first generation industry is. 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 First generation industry is.